May 9th, 1997 by John K. Smith of Lehigh University. Okay, Dr. Spanagel, first, let's just talk a little bit about your early origins, where you were born and when you were born and your family, what kind of family you came from.
All right. I was born in 1905 in a small dairy farm on the east side of the Horican Marsh in Wisconsin.
What marsh was that?
Horican, H-O-R-I-C-A-N. Mm-hmm. That's the headwater of the Rock River, which ultimately runs into the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. When I was about 7 years old, we moved to a small town, Waupun, Wisconsin, which is on the east side of the same marsh. My family finally consisted of one older sister and two younger brothers. My father died when I was 14 years old. And
still farming?
No, we were in Waupun at that time, and unfortunately left my mother with four small children from 14 to 2 years old, and not much money. So we were not a wealthy family. My schooling started actually on the farm. I went to a one grade, one class, one room schoolhouse, one teacher for all grades, if all the children came, or any. Some grades had no children, and some had one, some had two. My first school in Waupun was a two-room schoolhouse, had two floors, the bottom floor and the upper floor. The bottom floor took the first and second grade, and the second floor was the third and fourth grade. There was one teacher in each room. Beyond that, we usually had one teacher for one grade. I finally graduated from Waupun High School in 1924, and then went to Lawrence College. At that time, it's now Lawrence University, and was there from 1924 to 1928. And stayed on for 2 years in the chemistry department, mostly handling the laboratory, teaching laboratories in the school for the department. Then I went to McGill University.
Well, let's just back up. I want to ask just a few questions about this.
Okay.
How did you get, you weren't a chemist as an undergraduate?
No. You mean where?
At Lawrence. What did you study at Lawrence? And how did you end up going to college?
I was the first one of our whole relationship. My mother's had a sister and a brother, and they had children, and my father had sisters and brothers, and they had children. None of them ever went to college. Now, when I went to Waupun High School, I was getting pretty fair grades. As a matter of fact, I was salutatorian, which was second in class. And my teachers, of course, encouraged me very much to go to school, but I said, how could I do it? Well, because mother could not send me. Now, what happened while I was going to high school, even before I was going to high school, being situated as we were money-wise, we took any job we could get. And, for example, I mowed lawns for two widows for many years, 25 cents for one lawn, 35 cents for the other. But we did it. The last 2 years in high school, I worked before and after school in a grocery store. All of Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, Saturday all day, it's all night, and until 11 o'clock or so when farmers stopped coming in. And got paid for that. Not very much, but got paid. All this money I was putting in the bank pretty much because I didn't spend much. Well, at that time, we didn't have it to spend anyway. But by the time I got through high school, I had managed to save up about $1,000. So, with the encouragement I got from the teachers, and the fact that at that time there really wasn't much I could do except work in a grocery store or something like that, I decided to try to go to high school, to college, and decided on Lawrence.
Where is Lawrence College?
It's in Appleton, Wisconsin. It's now Lawrence University. And it was rated a good school for Wisconsin and fairly close to Waupun. Now, when I got there, we registered, and the one who I registered was the chemistry professor, Dr. Utes. And
was it Hughes?
Y-O-U-T-Z.
Oh, Utes. Utes. Y-O-U-T-Z.
Yeah. And he asked me what I'd taken in high school, and I said, well, I'd taken physics. The high school didn't offer chemistry. And he said, well, you didn't have any chemistry? And I said, no. He said, well, you ought to take one of your chemistry. So that was one of the first subjects I took. Well, as it turned out, I got a very high mark in chemistry, so the next year I registered and took it again. And took it every year after that, and that became my major. That's how I got started in chemistry.
You didn't have any family interest, or you just discovered it in college?
That's right. No one else had ever gone to college.
Right.
My father had never gone to college. My mother hadn't gone to college. At that time, people just didn't go to college. They were lucky to get through eighth grade. And so I had nobody except teachers to advise me, and they didn't advise me anything except they wanted me very much to go to college too. And so I decided to go, and not without some grumbling from people saying I ought to stay home and try to earn money for my mother. But anyway, I went, and in the first year of my college, I got something like a 93 or 94 grade. So I said I'd take another, try it again. And I kept on and went through the whole 4 years. And I was selected for a member of Phi Beta Kappa in the year, so I had done fairly well in college. And then they offered me a job to stay on and teach for 2 years.
Well, teaching the chemistry labs?
In the labs, yes. Which I did, but at the end of 2 years I recognized the fact that I couldn't stay there. And at that time there was a lot of discussion about graduate schools and you could get scholarships to go to them. And we had a new chemistry teacher.
Now, this was 1929?
No, let's see.
Where are we?
we're about 1930 now.
So the Depression has already... The Great Depression has already begun.
Yes, just started.
Right.
Just started. So the possibility of getting jobs is not very good. But with the 2 years in college that I'd worked at the end of it, I'd paid off all the more money I borrowed to go to college and had developed some extra so I could consider graduate school. And so we had a new professor in chemistry that came to Lawrence. He graduated from Harvard and he came to teach organic chemistry. And this is what I like best anyway, in the chemistry business. And So he wrote to various colleges for me to see if he could get a scholarship for me. Mm-hmm. One of the places he wrote was to McGill University because he knew Dr. Allen, who also was at Harvard the same time he was. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the first place I was offered a scholarship, so I went to McGill University and worked under Dr. Allen.
Did you consider Illinois? I mean, that they were the great magnet then in the Midwest with Adams and Marble.
Illinois and Minnesota, mm-hmm. which was Steve's home. Illinois, I didn't get a scholarship. Later, I was offered a scholarship at Minnesota, but I'd already accepted the one at McGill. Mm-hmm. So I went to McGill, and I was fortunate that I had this scholarship, and yet I was able to get a PhD without taking a master's in 3 years and still do the assistants I mm-hmm. had to do. And so when I got through at McGill with my PhD, the question of where to work.
What did you do your dissertation on?
Well, it was on anhydroacetone benzyl. It was I have a paper I can give you, and it will show you what that was all about. We solved the problem. All these problem solving, you know, the things you find out that when you solve a problem, it's pretty obvious when you get through the answer, but somehow you haven't done it before. Well, anyway, it's a fairly long story, and better give you the
okay. What was Montreal like in that period when you were there? Was that
Montreal? It was considered, I think, the best school in Canada.
Mm-hmm. But I mean the city. I mean, you came from a small town.
Oh yeah.
Montreal must have been a pretty exotic place.
Well, I didn't think so. It was a bigger city. No question mm-hmm. about that. But I lived very close to the campus at McGill.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I took an overnight train to get there from Wisconsin and just started looking for places to stay. And we ended up in a boarding house where they boarded McGill students. And for a while you could get meals there too, but most of the time you couldn't. But I got acquainted with the rest of the people that lived in there. Of course, quite a few people at McGill.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Allen was my professor, and I got along very well with him. And when I graduated, I don't know if you want to talk any more about McGill or not. I thought McGill was a good school, but how can I judge? I hadn't gone to many other
right. Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it is true that at that time, Harvard, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and a few of those places were considered the top place as far as chemistry is concerned, and especially organic chemistry at Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And at Harvard, and that's where both Steve Darling and Dr. Allen got their degrees
at Harvard.
At Harvard, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Allen recognizing the fact that I graduated that I need a job, he knew Wallace Brothers very well because Brothers also came from Harvard.
They had taught together at Harvard.
Yes. I don't know if Allen taught, but Crothers taught at Harvard.
Oh, he might have been one of Crothers' students?
He might have, but he knew him very well.
Yeah, Crothers was there from, 26 to 28?
Yeah.
I think he was at Harvard.
Oh, that was just about the time Dr. Allen was getting his degree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he wrote to Crothers, and Crothers turned the letter over to Tandberg.
Mm-hmm.
And Tandberg wrote me a letter and asked me to come down for an interview, which I did right after I got my PhD, and came down for the interview, and then back went back to Wisconsin, and in a few days I got a letter offering me a job for $175 a month.
What did you think? When you came down here for the interview, what did you see? Who did you talk to? What?
Dr. Tandberg.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Hamilton and Wallace Crothers.
Sarah Hamilton Bradshaw.
Hamilton Bradshaw.
And you talked to Crothers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, Crothers was the last one I talked to, and he took me back to the railroad station.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I got the offer and accepted it.
But I want to know, what was your impression of the place? What was your feeling about
I took a taxi out to the experimental station,
mm-hmm.
and went in, and this is a set of buildings, the laboratories and stuff like that. My impression was not from what I saw, but from what I heard. You see, the DuPont and chemistry, mostly from Allen and from various discussions, and I thought it was a good place to do work as far as I could see.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter, at that time there were PhDs walking the streets, and any job that was being offered,
so you weren't being too picky.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So now, is there anything else you'd like to know about my family? I covered it pretty fast, and you could say a lot of things about it. Was it difficult to go to college? And the answer is yes. And you lived out little as you could use, see.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first year of college I spent $500. I went to a small hotel and got a job waiting on table. I got my food for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got, a few tips, but my food mostly for that. And so then I just had to pay for my room and the tuition. And so if what I did was scrape and scrape to get through the first year, see. And I did that, and by that time I went back and worked summer and made money and put it back and had enough for the second year. See? So it was a year-to-year thing all the time, except towards the end I did borrow some money to go the last year. But I think the last year I only spent something like $1,100. When you consider that against what you have to start a day, you can't hardly start on $10,000 a year. If you have even Delaware, I think it costs you a lot. I don't know what the figure is nowadays. So it was tough, but you got used to doing without. That's what I did. Join a fraternity. It was cheaper to live there than any place else, because they immediately appointed me to work with a cook and getting meals, and I helped serve them, so I got my meals for that. This was after I stopped the last 2 years, mm-hmm. after I stopped working at the hotel. So I got my meals free practically for what I did, practically all 4 years I was in college. And then I had the 2 years afterwards, which I didn't get my meals free, but I was getting paid for that. The truth of the matter is, at that time nobody was showing a lot of money. You know, everybody was a little bit broke. So a lot of the people I was going to school with were not spending a lot of money either.
Mm-hmm.
So you had other people, so you didn't feel quite as
this
lonely.
This was still in the 20s, though.
This was before
20, the Depression.
Yeah. And now, in 28 or 29, the big Depression started.
The fall of 29,
yeah. Well, so I went to college, and from 33 during the Depression, really. And they paid me enough, so actually I just about could make it without borrowing any money to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got through here, I was at graduate school, through graduate school in 1933, about 28 years old, and no money. So I was, I would have accepted, I guess, any job.
Did you explore any other jobs teaching or in with other companies?
I was not too anxious to teach. I put an application in with a number of other companies, and some of my weren't interested. I did get an offer after I accepted the DuPont offer, but of course, once I accepted, I wasn't going to take another offer. The question of how much money, $175 a month, it's interesting. I went home and I had a grandfather who was 90 years old, and he more or less followed my career too. And he said, "You have a job?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How much are you going to get?" I says, $175 a month. He says, "My God, there isn't that much money in the world." he was raised on a farm all his life. He came over from Germany.
Uh-huh.
And my grandmother came over from Germany. They married here. And together they bought a farm, and they built the farm up, and they raised the farm, and their oldest son was running the farm, had the farm, and they were living with them.
Mm-hmm.
But he died shortly after I came. But I thought it was interesting. He said there wasn't that much money in the world, because they were used to the kind of pay. They used to get hired men. In the summer they would get something like $30-$35 a month in the summertime. In the wintertime they just get their keep, and this was to work on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't used to what you call big wages and big salaries, which have increased astronomically over the years.
So you must have felt, so what did you do with all your money?
You mean when I got?
Yeah. All of a sudden you were a rich young man.
Yeah. Well, I saved it.
You saved it?
3 years later I got married.
Uh-huh.
Now, you want to start on what I did with DuPont?
Yeah, sure. What do you remember? Do you remember your first day at work? A lot of people tend to remember that day.
Yeah, I think so. Kind of vaguely, but actually, the first day I came to work, I waited in Tenberg's office for a couple hours.
Couple of hours.
Because this was the summertime, July.
Uh-huh.
He had a place down in the lake, on the shore.
Oh.
And so and this was a Monday morning, and he didn't get back a couple hours late. So he immediately took me and took up to Crothers' office. He says, "Here's your man," and so he turned me over to Crothers. See? And Crothers said, "Well," he says, "Dr. Tanbrick says that you're going to become part of my group." He says, "This is what we're working on. I'd like to have you read the stuff we've been doing." And he says, "As far as you're concerned, after you see what some of this is going on, we have one problem that we'd like to have you work on a little bit. He says, we've been making these long polymers, and when we put them under vacuum, under certain conditions, we get a small amount of a large ring compound.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't do it at all consistently. And what I'd have, I want you to do is find out how to do this consistently when you get at it. So, of course, I read what they've been doing and the kind of work they were doing and what they're working with. And so I got together with a glass blower and build a machine so I could regulate the heat and the vacuum and one thing or another in taking this polymer and trying to make a large ring. Now, the only reason for really doing that was a kind of vague. You had the knowledge that Staudinger had defined a large ring compound in as being giving off a musk odor, and that he identified the ring that did that. It came from sick whales or something like that. And so theoretically, if we could manufacture a 17 member ring, we should have stuff with musk odor. And they'd had some indication that this was true with the little stuff they had. So I made some polymer and put it in this equipment I'd built, I hadn't built, and put the vacuum on, and nothing much happened for 2-3 times. And in about third or fourth time I tried to do this, all of a sudden it started to spill over, and I got a fairly good amount of stuff over that was all the ring compound. And checking through what was doing it, I found out the vacuum had to be very, very good, below a certain amount. When you do that, then you worked on that and got the vacuum down, and it did it every time. And so now we knew how to make it. Now, this was only the carbonyl rings, and we're working on mostly the 10 carbon glycol carbonyl. That would give a 13 carbon ring. But what we're really after is 17. So then the next went and figured out a way to develop a 14 member glycol, and with the carbonyl, I made the carbonyl polymer for that, and put it under this vacuum, and also got this 17 member ring, and sure enough it had this musk odor, which I would expect. So immediately we went up and talked to our chem department.
Okay. So what did the OrChem people think about it?
Well, the OrChem people were excited too. Of course, this wasn't all entirely new to them, because of course Crothers had been talking to other people, so everybody knew what was coming up, they knew also. But they had a research laboratory, I think, in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in a plant there. So Crothers took me up there with this stuff and told them, because the OrChem people decided that they'd want their people to take it over from the experimental station. So they sent me up there for, well, we went up there and talked about it, and they said, yeah, but I went up there for about a month. Drove back on the weekend, drove up there during the week to work with them, to show them how to make this 14 carbon glycol,
mm-hmm.
and the carbon, and how to get it into a ring. And from there on, they took it over, and they put this on the market as one of the compounds they had for sale, for perfume chemicals they had for sale. Now,
what were your impressions of, and yeah, you're just a new guy on the block. How, yeah. What did you see around you? Well, how did Carruthers Group work, and what was the atmosphere like at this time? And
well, it was really not much different from a college atmosphere in many ways. I mean, you talk to everybody, and they talk to you, and we had meetings. Carruthers, we talk about papers and various in the magazines as well as things we're working on. But Carruthers was very much a hands-off supervisor. Sometimes I wouldn't see him for 3-4 days.
He'd just give you a project and say,
"We'd
here,
give you a project,
go solve this problem."
Yeah. Pretty much so. If you had any problems, you could go and discuss it with him.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much he was there to help you. I mean, what do you need to do these things that you wanted to do? And well, we handed over this particular compound to our chem people. They taught them how to make it, and they went ahead and commercialized it. Of course, it's one of these very expensive chemicals, mm-hmm. but perfumes can handle it. And I never really knew if it was doing anything or not. I mean, financially.
Right.
I came back to Wilmington and started working, said, well, presumably I was still working on ring compounds as far as Carruthers was concerned. And I said, well, there's something funny. You can do it with carbonyls. Why can't you do it with any polyester? You should be able to do it with any polyester. And I said, maybe there's a catalyst someplace. So I went in, we had a little laboratory, a laboratory storeroom, and they had a lot of chemicals on. I started picking them off of the shelf and going in and trying those catalysts on this one here, one there. And didn't take long. I found one that worked on, it wasn't a carbonyl, it was probably ethylene glycol and sabacic acid, Paul, because
mm-hmm.
those were too easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried several more, and I found that the cobaltic chloride would not work, but cobaltous chloride would work.
Mm-hmm.
Stannous chloride would work, but I never got around to finishing all that, because then I had one, and I said, well, we don't have to go through this 14 carbon thing. We can now deal with something here that's available. And brucellic acid, which is the 13 carbon dibasic acid, and ethylene glycol together would make a 17 member ring.
Mm-hmm.
So I made that polymer and found you could make the ring out of it, and it also smelled like musk. And so Carruthers handed that information to them, they carried it from them. And I was, and then said, well, I can work on all other kinds of rings, I see how many I can make. And I was getting, and one of the dibasic acids that was available was terephthalic acid. It's benzene with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I started making terephthalic acid polymers, and with something like a 10 carbon dibasic acid, I could make a ring for that too. And then I said, well, I wonder how small they've been. I made it with ethylene glycol, which we now know
is. Yes, right. I know what that is.
Yeah.
Polyester, the polyester.
Yeah, the polyester.
Dacron, as yeah. DuPont calls it.
And I could not make a ring out of it. And I had it out there on the desk, and Crothers came in and looked at it. He looked at it, he got up and walked away. And I never talked about it again. I never understood that quite, because I wasn't smart enough to pick out the fact that I should look at the polymer. And I was that time looking at rings. See, I wasn't very interested.
Was this before or after the big nylon breakthrough in May of 34?
Before.
This was before May of 34, before the Kaufman makes the amino caproic acid.
No. I was in the same laboratory with Kaufman when he was doing this work. I was doing all this work I told you about at the same time when he's doing it. I saw Kaufman when he got this little chunk of about the size of a Hershey Kiss polymer out of this amino acid. And I saw him, I was there, we were talking about trying to spin this thing through a hypodermic needle.
Right.
Oh, yeah. And he just got, the amount of thread he got was in yards, not in skeins or anything like that. And all the testing of his had to be done there. That was done while I was doing this, see. And then they had started to this looks so good.
Right.
And they started looking at all kinds of polyamides.
The polyester just sat there.
Oh, yeah, just polyester.
And Carruthers never think that you could make a decent polymer out of, a decent fiber from a polyester.
The thing that always surprised me as I looked back at it through my mind was, when he saw that polymer sitting there, that I said I couldn't make a ring out of that.
Right.
And it was a good hard polymer that actually was a bit dirty, a bit of color, but it was a good hard polymer.
It was a hard polymer.
Oh, yes.
You had actually polymerized it.
Oh, yes.
You had a high polymer.
Oh, yes, a high polymer. I don't know if it's high enough to make a fiber.
Yeah, so did that sample survive?
No. I threw it away.
Yeah, so no one ever knew whether you were really the inventor of.
Well, they knew I made polyester.
But you don't know whether you made a polymer that could have produced a fiber.
No, but you could soon figure out. Well, let me go on with what.
Okay.
What happened is I was working with these rings, and Crothers came in one day. This was shortly after. We handed the stuff over. Crothers came in and said, we've got to stop this. We got this work on polyamides going on. He says, if we can't consistently make polymers that are high enough in metal weight to spin, and we've got to stop doing it, because I want you to go out and see what you can do about making polymers, polyamides. So I stopped. And I started looking at all the work they'd done. And I was talking to Tanberg. And Tanberg says, he says, the thing we really ought to do, we should focus on, is hexamethylene adipate. Because what other power,
right.
What other material can we get? We have a source of to get the material from. What else is there?
The benzene.
Yeah.
Right, from coal at this point, right?
Coal or
yeah.
They were getting it from oil too.
Mm-hmm.
So I really started. working on 6-6 right away. I made a few of the others, but I was making him, fortunately, and I think this is one of the very important discoveries that was made, I think Peterson made it, that you could put the diamine and the dibasic acid together and make a salt.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave you a 1-to-1 ratio.
Right.
Now that was one of the big problems with making polymers from a dibasic acid.
And getting a high molecular weight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you get it unbalanced, you just can't do it.
Right.
So, making sponge, which we heat them up, the wire would come off, you'd have the polymer left, and you'd vacuum it and go as far as it go. But it wasn't very good. I mean, you know, it's right on the edge. It's just about spinning and doesn't quite, not right. So I said, there must be something going on wrong. So I said, that if we start out with balance, why should I do this? And so I looked at the water, and I found out that it had a lot of amine in it. What we were doing was distilling some amine. So I called, I think it was still Crothers. We're now getting into the area when Crothers was going over to Europe, and George Graves was taking over, and I think this was still Crothers. Anyway, I talked to Crothers. I says, we're losing it here. I think the thing we have to do is make it under pressure so we can carry the reaction a lot further before we take the water off. And he agreed. So we got the engineers in, and he says we got to have an autoclave. We described a kind of, and then I worked to find out what metal would be made, and the only one that really gave the first try, didn't color the polyamide, was silver. So so the first autoclave we got
the
was...
The managers loved that.
The first autoclave we got was silver lined.
Uh-huh.
And...
You want to get that? Or?
No, but she...
Okay.
And?
Yeah, she's getting it.
Yeah. It was silver lined. But we got the autoclave, and I made polymer. First polymer was fine. Second polymer. The whole problem was solved as far as making polymer that would work. If you do it this way, you don't take the amine off and you make high molecular weight. Well, as you know and you've written about, to not make it too high, they put the acetic acid.
Right.
That was written up as a big discovery.
Mr. Smith.
Yes, that's Mr. Smith. Wait a minute.
That when we were trying to put together the, you know, the story of the development of nylon, it was very technically complicated, and
yeah.
I don't feel like, you know, we didn't get everything.
Oh, you're talking about your book.
In our book, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
We didn't. We tried.
Yes. Well, I don't understand. Well, actually, the thing that solved making the polymer, there are probably other ways to do it, was to make it under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
and that was the thing that upset the balance.
Right.
And you see, we were talking about this acetic acid. Actually, you could have added a little extra dipic acid, would have done the same thing. You could have added any other single carbon acid, would have done the same thing. It just cuts off the ends and doesn't let it grow, see.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Acetic acid was good because it was the cheapest. single acid that you get. So we put some of that in to prevent it getting so thick that you could melt it and it wouldn't run. You see, that's the other, you get, when it gets too thick, then you can't handle it in the spinning process.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, after you get polymer, then I became the source of polymer for all the work to do on the spinning deals.
Mm-hmm.
And to find out what the fibers were really like, they had to make some
right.
and test the fibers. So
what size batches were you making?
2 pounds a day.
Mm-hmm. Still in your silver.
In
your silver autoclave.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, we found out that stainless steel, which gave it a little bit of a gray color, when you did it once, if you did it 2-3 times, it didn't do that because you have to pickle stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that, and I didn't talk to the right metallurgist, I guess, to begin with. But after that, something happened to the silver lining, and it blew a hole through the part that they had to put it. They had to put a hole in the steel to get the silver lining all the way on the autoclave, and that hole finally got a hole in it, so we couldn't use it. See, so then we got a stainless steel autoclave, the same size in this place, and it worked perfectly all right after the first batch. The first batch was gray, but after that they were fine. So after that they were all stainless steel. And that's really what it went to all the way to the plant. Nobody really concerned about the next big process is to get the next autoclave that would make a bigger amount.
Right.
So we had the engineers in getting ready to build an autoclave for the assembly works. This was, I think this one gave 50 pounds at a crack. But that took several months. So here I was the source of polymer. And then they decided that they were going to set up 3 shifts a day in the semi-works. Well, I, being the youngest guy, had to take one of those shifts. They got somebody else to make the polymer, and I went on one of those shifts.
Running the semi-works.
Yeah. At that time, it was mostly concerned with making hexamethylene diamine from adipic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
the sticky process of
right.
being on was make a dipronitrile, which could then be hydrogenated to the diamine. And the catalyst could plug and everything else. And one night I was there and I had one helper. We were the shift. We cleaned the stuff out, put new stuff
in. You're making monomer and polymer.
Well, at that time, somebody else was making the polymer because of
that. You weren't making the hexamethylene diamine.
We were making trying to make a dipronitrile.
Okay, right.
The semi-works got finished in pieces, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing was this machine because they wanted to test making this a dipronitrile. They had to have that to get the diamine. And they were doing it in the laboratory. This was a scale-up. And the scale-up wasn't working. The catalyst would get plugged. And what they had was they'd pump this molten adipic acid through a nozzle to make a mist out of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then put ammonia in with it, and that put that through the catalyst. Now, so we cleaned it out one night, and we started up, and I started the ammonia through, and I just turned the acid pump on very slowly. So we just got a little bit of adipic acid in there, and sure enough, we got some diamine. Now, when I left the morning shift, they started turning it up where it should be, plugged it right up again, which then led to them saying, well, you can't do it that way. So then what they did is pumped it in the top and put it on this rotating disc you talked
mm-hmm.
about, it, and sprayed it on the sides of the wall, and that actually vaporized it, see, instead of misting
mm-hmm.
it. The mist was too much, plugged it up.
Right.
And they also had equipment in there to make salt, but we didn't have enough diamine yet to make salt. And, and then became the Palmer. But I worked at that, oh, I don't know, several months. And then they, when I got off of that, they says, we're having a problem with the yarn, because we not only have to make it, we have to make it so it works on a full-fashioned hosiery machine, because that's the kind they have in this country. Almost all of the women's stockings are made of full-fashioned hosiery machine. So, I started looking for something that we could put on the yarn that would make it act like silk. Well, I found the usual available materials didn't look good at all. We did have, at that time, a single machine up Buffalo. That by this time, they'd gotten a machine to make hosiery, one stocking at a time, on a single machine. Mm-hmm. And it had a man up there that could do this. So we had a way of testing stuff that when you had something that you wanted tested, you gave it to him and he'd see if he could make stuff. Well, the thing that happened to all these things, most of these buggered up the machinery, see. Had to clean it off, and also, well, if it was sticky, stick on the machine and break the yarn, so then you couldn't make it. And that spoiled the stocking. So, I finally went to synthetic materials and got a poly acid that was water soluble, tried it on, worked pretty well. And I made quite a bit of it. I mean, made quite a bit of yarn, and they sent it up to North Philadelphia. At that time, they'd rented a knitting machine. They were making full-fashioned hosiery. One machine they'd rented to put on any kind of yarn we wanted to put on. Well, they were running all these yarns over, and first thing you knew, we were eating up the needles. Mm. And so that was all. So I had to start over again. And then I started another polymer that was water soluble, was sticky. And we went to the people who made it, and they said, well, you can harden it with borax. And so I tried borax, and it hardened film all right. Now, the way I measured this by making a film out of it, by putting a little bit on a glass plate, mm-hmm. and letting it dry. That's the way I could feel the film. But actually, on the fiber, we put in solution, run the yarn over a roll that was bringing the solution up to the yarn, mm-hmm. and then winding it up. And that's what we were sending to the knitting mills to try. Well, when we tried this with the borax on it, it was so sticky that it buggered up the needles and stuck and broke the yarn. So that was good. So I tried boric acid instead of borax. Well, that ended up with a totally different feeling film. It was hard, but it also was slippery when you wet it. So we put that on it, and that was the stuff that we finally went to the end of the plant with, and that was the size that we sent to the knitting mills, and that's where what. Now the purpose of this size on the hosiery yarn was only that when it came off, the nylon stocking used to roll up so that the girls could not unroll it easily, because they had to sew up the back seam. You know, mm-hmm. all this.
Right.
Now, the only purpose of this whole thing was just so the women could sew up the back seam. Now, the thing we never realized is what was going on at the same time was his finding that the hosiery didn't behave itself afterwards unless you did what we call boarding it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think John Miles did quite that. You put it on a form and then you put it under heat, steam heat, under higher than ordinary steam is, under some pressure I think it is, and the yarn hugs the board and sets. You get a permanent set into the yarn so that and that follows, that led to really the revolution that in making stockings, almost all stockings after this was fully realized are now made by making a tube.
Mm-hmm.
Putting that on a form, and when you board it like that and get steam set and get this permanent set, it still looks like a stocking, although it started out like a tube. Now that's the thing, wonderful thing about that setting process, and nylon that it will do that. Now the other thing you have to realize is the whole Velcron business in this country that takes nylon and makes it sets, puts in certain forms, sets and cuts it in such a way that when you look at the fiber, it looks like a small cane, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they do is the bottom end of the cane, they put it on the fabric on both sides. When you put it together, these hooks hook together. That's what Velcro is. Mm. You know the stuff you...
Right.
Yeah. And that, you can do that because nylon takes a set.
Hmm.
You never see any other yarn that they can't do with other yarns because it doesn't make that hook so,
mm-hmm.
which opens up when you tear it like, when you just turn it over like that, you can open it, but you just pull it, it's hard to open, see? So it makes a good mm-hmm. closing. Well, that's all based on that setting in yarn.
really make a big, that really make a big difference in whether something works or not.
I have a feeling, you know, we talk a lot about, well, somebody made a big decision here, somebody made a business, and most of the progress in nylon was made by what the polymer and the yarn would do, not by what people said. And this is true actually with polyester too. You see, they tried to force it into tartar cord before it was ready. The yarn dictates, the product dictates what's good. People can't dictate to that. And in spite of the fact that you'd like to, I guess. Well, let's see, where are we?
You were talking about the sizing problem. But I'd like to stop a little bit here and talk about Carruthers and your interaction with him, your impressions of him. And again about your group and DuPont and Bolton and the whole group that you were working for and Greenwald. This must have been a very exciting time.
It was
it must have been very sad.
You see, when I was in the of course, you see, I was not with Carruthers that long. I put down some dates here that I tried to think of so I wouldn't. See, I started the company in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And all this work on this large range stuff, I was through with that in 1935. It was just 2 years. In 2 years, and then in 1935, about late 34, 35, I was put back on this nylon job trying to make the polymer. And I started that when I was working with Carruthers. He's the one that put me on the job. But I was making polymers when Carruthers went over to England.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took all the nylon people and put them over with the rayon department.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then reported to George Graves. So, you see, there was a period I didn't know who I was reporting to. But all this work after the small autoclave, after I finally did the semi-work stint, and came off, all the work on the sizing, I think, was done when Carruthers was, I was really reporting to Carruthers, sir.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of happened, you didn't know it was happening for sure, and then Carruthers came back, and I talked to him after that, but I was no longer reporting to him. I was reporting George Graves. And they gave us a chance to either, they gave me a chance to either stay or go with the nylon, and I chose to go with it. And some people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Don Kaufman decided not to, and several others. I don't really know who was asked to go and who wasn't. I know I was asked to go and I went. And from then on, I reported to Carruthers. I mean, to George Graves.
Graves.
Yeah. And so I didn't really get to know Carruthers very well. Now, all my dealings with Carruthers were wonderful. I mean, he came and we'd talk about the work, and sometimes I wouldn't see him for a week, and there were times when he left go places and I didn't see him at all. I remember one day when I was working on these ring compounds and just had found out a few things about making something besides a carbonyl, he came in and he says, I have to report to our, I guess they call it the steering committee, what the chemical department had. And I don't have any talk about it. I says, well, you can, I bought a bottle. I says, this is all this rig compound I made this way because I found a catalyst for it. Oh, he says, you have that. Yes, that. He went away. He's just happy as could be. And that's the kind of fellow he was. I mean, he was nice to work for. I don't think that I saw him between the times he's away and the times I was with sometimes I wouldn't see him more than twice a month, you know, and so that I didn't really get to know him very well. And the only personal contact I had with him, I had with him very early, that's when the time we went up to New Brunswick, we came back on the train, it was late, and I was living in a bachelor house at that time. And he said, yeah, how about dinner? And I says, well, I'll find something somewhere. Well, he says, I have my girl making dinner for you. Why don't you come over and have dinner with me? So I went over, and we had a drink, had dinner, and talked. And I thought he was very pleasant.
Where was he living then? Was that in Arden?
No, he was living in an apartment
on Wawasset.
Wawasset apartment, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who fixed the dinner?
He had a girl come in every day to fix dinner for him.
He did?
Yeah.
Wow.
At that time. Well, you know, girls were cheap in those days.
I know, and men didn't cook.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's really fascinating.
Now, as far as the... Then I got, you know, we got into this nylon group. And they, of course, they brought quite a few people into the nylon group. And there was, it wasn't long, it must have been, there was a one time there, they had a Modern Pioneers celebration. Did you hear about that?
No. Oh, in Seaford. Or is that up here?
No, this was nationwide.
Oh.
They had regional meetings. We went to Philadelphia. With nylon, that was a product DuPont had that was picked out. Land with his camera, and there were about 10 people. That we all ended up in New York, and nylon was the only one that had more than one person. We had about a dozen people, well, maybe about 8, 10 or something like that. And I was one of those. We went up to New York. George Graves, Crothers had killed himself. And George Graves is sitting at the, up the, on a big table up above, and we were in a table down below. But we were all introduced. But this was for our work at nylon, and there were quite a few people there. Wendy Heckert was there. And,
What year was this?
Well, I'm trying to think.
Well, approximately.
Oh, about 39, 38, 39. Mm-hmm. And that'd be in that period.
Mm-hmm.
I had never heard any more about it since that. It was a kind of an... They had... That time they didn't have... they just had radio. So they broadcast it all by radio. There was no television.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I told my family out in Wisconsin they were going to be on, and they listened to that. So that was kind of exciting. But there were a lot of things like that going on. And then, of course... just being into the development of a product that showed so much promise, and everyone around was so enthusiastic, it was a wonderful feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful to do. As far as I was concerned,
you want Joe Lebowski?
Joe Lebowski, he's out here.
He's here. No, not this. I don't know. Dissonant.
Yeah.
Get a ride.
Who was that?
Joe.
Get a ride to where?
Back to his house, I guess.
Oh.
Okay.
Now, let's see. Now it's... What is it? We're at the point now where that...
Well, we're going to build a plant in Seaford?
Yes. And the development work... Well, during both that period, I was working on this size and making, putting size on the yarn and testing it and having it tested in the knitting mills. And it basically got down to this polymer with the boric acid work. That's the one we went to the plant with, and that's the only one that the plant people ever put on in the plant. At the present time, I don't think they're making that kind of yarn, because I don't think they're making stockings that way anymore. They're making them either out of single filaments like 30 denier, and they're making almost all of those by making a tube, putting it off form, and it melts down and gives a leg shape. And the difference in density of the yarns here and the leg and below doesn't make that much difference, so you don't have to go through all the problems. So the size was only so you could run it on full-fashioned machines.
Mm-hmm.
It served absolutely no other purpose, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't important. It's a little bit like the business of this acetic acid. Well, I don't think they use that anymore. What they do now is, instead of using nitrogen as really nitrogen without any oxygen, special nitrogen as a blanket, they now use steam. And with steam, it cuts down enough on the size so they don't have to use acetic acid in the mix anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it was a very convenient early thing, but
sure.
They now do different things, so some of these things are ephemeral and disappear. Of course, I haven't been in now. I can briefly review what happened to me, because shortly after class started, they asked me if I would go down there as a plant technical superintendent. And so, of course, you never turned down a job, a promotion, you see.
So you moved to Seaford?
Yeah, I moved to Seaford. I was there 3 years, from 1940 to 43. And then they brought me back to the experimental station as manager of nylon research. And he's working for Wendy Hecker. He was the laboratory director of nylon research, and I was his next man. And I worked there 3 years until 1947, and then they asked me to go up to Buffalo to be the head of the cellophane research. I didn't know a damn thing about cellophane.
In that period with nylon, what sorts of things were you working on in nylon in that at Seaford? Were there problems or
at Seaford? The problems were keeping the plant running and finding out why things weren't going the way they should go. I noticed that as hardly gotten down there, they had a problem. The filaments in the spinning were touching as other than blowing around funny. And I just had a little between the time they offered me a job and the time I went down there, they told me to learn a little bit about spinning. So I went down there and we watching spin yarns and what they did and what they didn't do, and played around with various polymers which I had them spin for me and that kind of stuff. And so they said, "My gosh, what's going on?" So I said, I had some experience in some spinning I was doing up here, having the same problem. Found out the screens that were letting the air in had gotten dirty, and that was causing all kind of funny drafts. And so I said, "Why don't you just clean out the screens?" And they said, "Well, we just changed our schedule. We've done it so often that we reduced that." I said, "Clean out the screens, they clean it out, there's no problem." It was that kind of problem that you're facing all the time. See, this was happening, that was happening. And there were, for example, one of the machines, it suddenly came back to us from somebody that they were getting bar raised in the stocking. We went and looked at the machines, and we looked at them with a stroboscope. They were doing this, you know, they were speeding up a little. At each rotation, they were speeding up and slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
And that would give her a barre in the stretching.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to get the cogwheels just lined perfectly so it wouldn't do this kind of stuff, and that solved that problem. Little bit of nasty problems that all of a sudden we saw. Then we got into war period, you know, and we were making yarn for the parachutes. And in order, we didn't want to put as much titanium dioxide in that material because it was, if you put it out in the sun, it was a little more subject to degradation with the titanium dioxide than without it, see. So we want to leave that out so it would be a chance of the parachute yarn standing in the sun too much and getting weakened. Well, anyway, they were having a problem at that time. The second plant was going at Martinsville, and they couldn't keep on making this yarn for some reason or other. And we had a man look around at, and he says, "All we can find is that you Seaford's making it all right. The only difference is Seaford makes the bright yarn, we call that a bright yarn, and it makes the polymer in the same autoclave as it makes the other one." Yeah. So I said, "Well, it has to be a little bit of TI too." And so we told Martinsville to put just a trace of this TiO2 in it. Titanium dioxide is in stockings to make them less transparent, you know.
Mm-hmm. It makes them more opaque.
More opaque. Yeah. Well, they did that with just trace, and all their drawing problems stopped. So it was that kind of little bit of crappy problems that you kept on solving.
Did you like solving those? Did you like being an engineer? Did you like that sort of problem solving? Because you went from being a chemist to being more like an engineer, I guess.
No, well, some of them were chemistry and some were actually, there was even the chemical problems get to be kind of obvious after you solve them, you know? When you get even problems I solved, which I thought were chemistry, they were just problems that make sense after you solve them. You say you should have known that all the time. And when I look back at the problem I worked at in McGill, when I got the problem solved that gave me my PhD, I said, "My God, I should have seen that." But people have been looking at it for 20 years and hadn't seen it. See? So that's the kind of... I don't see much difference in being a chemist and being an engineer. You have problems and you try to solve them. And sometimes they're chemical, but many times they aren't really very chemical. They're just logic.
Mm-hmm.
So Actually, I like research work, and I must admit that that when it gets down to, well, what happened to me was I then went up to Buffalo and I stayed there 3 years, and during that time we developed Mylar yarn, Mylar film, which is, and actually we developed a continuous process for making the polymer. As soon as the fiberboys did, see. But they weren't very anxious to do it because they already had prepped to spin and so forth. But in with the film, making Mylar film, we almost have to have a continuous process because you have to feel all this stuff out to the film system, and you can't stop that kind of thing. And you can't do it with a little melter, so we developed a continuous process for making polyester film, and developed a film process, and then you had to have a way not only to stretch it this way, you had to stretch it that way.
In both directions.
In both directions.
What are they, biaxial or?
And they were working on some kind of roller system that, when I went up there, that was supposed to do it. But I talked to Clarence Coleman, who was doing some of this work. He was a supervisor up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, well, suppose, don't we have any equipment around the country that does? Well, he says, the closest to it is a tenor frame that uses fabrics. It's something that grabs it on the side. Well, I says, can't we get them to make a machine and then build it so close like that? He says, I don't know. So they went, found out, sure, they'd build it for us. So they did. And that's how we brought on the, you know, we cast it onto a roll, and cooled it and drew it lengthwise first, and then had the tenor firm grab it and pull it out this way, and built the whole plant that way, and it worked.
Mm-hmm. When you first got to Buffalo, was that a problem that was lying there? Or is that what they were working on when you
no.
got up there?
When I got up to Buffalo, I said to myself, I says, now why would the hell would they send me up here? I don't know a damn thing about cellophane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know even how to make cellophane. I mean, now I can go out and watch it, but I don't know anything about cellulose, really, except what you learned in college. I says, well, what? So I start looking at all the stuff they were working on. And they're working on a lot of different things. But none of them were coming to fruition, see? They were working on a continuous process for xanthine. And they had a new coating for the cellophane. But none of them were getting sold, even made in the plant. I says, then why aren't we doing this? I started putting emphasis on let's get some of these things done. So we soon got putting up a semi-works to make xanthate continuously, and we had all the plants changed over inside of 3 years. And as far as this new coating was concerned, I said, well, it's a little more expensive, but maybe we can find somewhere. And I said, well, why can't we put it on a film? There were some packages being made, they put two coats of cellophane on it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, for the new coat, we take just a little bit of heavier cellophane and put one coat of this kind of stuff on it and sell it, and they'll make money, we will too. So we did that for a long time. And of course, eventually they went over completely to that. But the main thing I thought I did was I said, well, let's pick out one of these other films you're looking at. They were already working on polyethylene, but they weren't getting anything to the point where you were really considering it seriously. And I already picked out polyester film as something we ought to look at, because that was just coming in then.
Mm-hmm.
And they had done some work on nylon and film, but not very much. And I says, well, let's start on that. And so we started on it, and it wasn't, well, in 3 years, we'd go to SemiWorks, and then we were breaking cello and this Mylar film, and getting people to look at it. And the reason I was moved down here is they wanted me to be in the manufacturing division, because they decided they were going to build a Mylar plant, and so that I could kind of watch the Mylar plant. You see, now I'm getting away completely from chemistry. It's no longer chemistry. And actually, the fun jobs are the jobs out doing the work. When you get in Wilmington, that's no fun anymore.
So when the Mylar found its big market in photographic film as a really unique kind of product.
Oh, I don't know where it's all going now.
But it's really unique contribution.
Yeah, of course the natural is magnetic tapes.
Right.
Almost all
right.
Magnetic
yes.
tapes.
Right.
I think.
Yes, I think so.
And I'm sure that a lot of other things are
right.
useful
now.
I have been away from it 30 years, so I
yes.
don't know what it all
yes.
amounts to. But the biggest thing we had there. There are a lot of. They've now put it. Oh, well, before I left DuPont, we were coating it. And so it had a lot of coating uses where, you know, once in a while you get a bag that's so damn hard to open.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably Mylar, coated Mylar, you see. They're selling quite a bit, I think, for packaging purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't really know where it's all going on. But before I left, the polyethylene film, not polyethylene, the polyester film was making as much money as cellophane was.
Yeah.
And so the biggest thing I added to that, as far as I'm concerned, is just concentrating attention on something and trying to carry it through to completion. Now that's not being a chemist or anything else, and it's supervision. But actually, the people doing it are enthusiastic when you get them into it, because nothing is as interesting as I don't know where else to go. I retired in 1965.
Well, what did you do when you came down from Buffalo? You came down here and...
Well...
What were your jobs you had then?
Well, actually, I started out as assistant to Candy Manufacturing. Director of Manufacturing. And what you do is go around to the plants, and I specifically tried very hard to keep up with their technical work on the plants. And what I tried to instill in them is they should be working all the time, and what is the next step this plant should take to make it a better plant, bigger plant, or a bigger producing plant.
And so there were problems like that. And all the plants got, so they kept on working on plans to expand their own plant. And then, if there are modifications in cellophane or Mylar, those things like that, why you kind of keep an eye on how those things were developing. But it's not like doing it yourself, or not like being right next to it, mm-hmm. because you're now talking to somebody who's then talking to somebody who's and you're a long ways away from them. People are doing the work, and you're only there for a short time. Now, it pays well. it's not, you don't get the same fun out of it to get out of research, but it's not nothing I had the guts to turn down.
But you really didn't enjoy managing people as much as you liked doing the actual.
That's right.
Doing the real work.
I like to work with the things. Uh-huh. You know, the problem, you can work with chemicals, and you find they'll do the same thing every time. So you do it the same way. And
with people, it doesn't work that way.
That's right. With people, it doesn't work that way. And I don't think I was really ever too good with people. I'm not a public speaker. I don't like public speaking. And I'm not happy doing it. And I don't do well. I don't know. And so I really was happier when I was in the laboratory. But there's no going back once you're down that road. I don't think you'll go back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know Crothers, he was very insistent that he wanted to, but Crothers, there's one thing in Crothers' life that I haven't seen that I was a little surprised at, and that is Paul Fleury. He lived at the same bachelor house I did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with Crothers, and he and Crothers developed, they both are crazy about fundamental research, and they developed this process of measuring the size of the distribution of the molecules and all that kind of stuff. And published papers, and Fleury left and went to his place. Continuous work on polymers, and eventually got the had
the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm. Chemistry, which if Crothers had lived and published all those years, I don't know. Have a strong feeling he could have got it.
Yes, probably.
Well, he might have. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they held off giving it to Staudinger for a long time.
They did. Yeah. They did.
Yeah. Polymers were always, I think, a little bit. Real chemists didn't always give
it's
polymers.
It's a little bit dirty because it's you're looking for something practical.
Yes. So yeah. Staudinger didn't even get it until 1960, I think.
But nobody seems to refer much to Paul Fleury, and he must have done some good work because he did get the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
He's dead too, unfortunately.
So how did he find DuPont? Guys were living together?
He quit.
Yeah. But he was here for a couple of years.
Oh, more than that, I guess. Maybe three or four.
Yeah, three or four.
And then he went up, he moved around several places, mm-hmm. ended up Stanford University.
Right.
And I only casually kept track of him, but I'd see him occasionally at some meeting or something. And we lived in the same bachelor house, so we got to know each other quite well. He was a smart guy, but he didn't like brothers put him on, just before he died, I think, he put him on trying to do organic chemical work, you know, make polymers and do stuff like that. And that wasn't for his, he liked the theoretical book work, you know, what's the shape of them and how many and what it look like. This matter of putting two things together and making something come out, didn't like that. That, I think that's why he left. He just didn't enjoy the film. And then, I don't know for sure if he left before Carlos died. I think he left
after.
And see, Carlos' work, as Carlos looked at it, it was completely gone, except maybe Julian Hill kept some in. But as far as the people like George Graves, I don't know who Paul Frey reported to after that. After he reported to George Graves for a while, they couldn't get along together at all. And so...
Graves was very practical-minded?
Oh, yeah. Oh, very, yeah. Very. He was a good supervisor, but he was just the opposite kind. He was a fellow, you may see him 2-3 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was going to make some, we were going to try a new autoclave, the first, you know, that autoclave they built out there. We were going to make the first, and he came down, he says, I think we only made a good start. I says, I already got it started. I started that long ago, because I thought it was time to start too, I guess. I don't know why. But that's the kind of guy he was. He was Carruthers, was not a close supervisor. Graves was very, actually, they offered me the job to go down to Seaford, and I was technical superintendent. And he used to come down, you know, for periodic visits, about once every 2 weeks. And we reviewed for him all the work he'd been doing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know him pretty well. And then, of course, he left. He went with this atomic energy thing. Wendy Hedrick took it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working for Wendy. Of course, when I went to Buffalo, then I was working for Carnes up there. George Carnes is the head of the cellophane research. But George went on a sabbatical or something. And, I said, what happened? They sent him to Europe when the war was over to find out what they could find out in Germany.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they just sent me to Buffalo. And the first thing that came up was a new budget for the next year. My God, so I had to get a budget together. And I came down and reviewed it with Artie Kunzman and whoever was head of the cellophane division at the time. But this fellow looked at it. It used to be that they did 90% of their work on cellophane, 10% on new yarn. Well, I came down with a program of doing about 40% on cellophane, 60% on him. He got off, my God, we did. And so he got up and walked off. I said, Artie, I'm sorry. He said, don't be sorry, you're doing exactly right. So Artie, so I got a feeling they sent me up there
to do that. Right.
And I'm glad I was able to do it. But it's all the trouble with this kind of reporting. You can't do it without kind of sounding like you're bragging. And maybe it is. Maybe maybe other people saw it entirely differently than I did, you see, because I saw it from one point of view, and other people see it from some other point of view. But there, for example, in polyester film, as far as I know, there has never been a bonus given for the development of polyester film. Now, there's a bonus given from now on, but there's never one for polyester film. And I guess it's just too much trouble to get it. It must have been a hell of a job to do it for now on, and probably it's too much trouble to do it for polyester film. And maybe it wasn't enough new developments, but... It's just an interesting byline, which I hope you won't publish.
No, we can leave that off if you want to.